This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Let me do a very quick introduction to the panel, and then we'll get into the discussion. Sitting next to me is Lynn Vavrick, who is Associate Professor of Political Science and Communication Studies at UCLA. She's also the director of the UCLA Center for the Study of Campaigns. Her most recent book is The Message Matters: The Economy and Presidential Campaigns. However, she also has a very interesting book coming out called The Gamble: Choice and Chance in the 2012 Presidential Election, which she co-wrote with John Sides, largely writing it during the campaign as the events unfolded. Some of that has been published on the internet already, and the book itself will be published in August of this year. Her research has been published widely. She's written for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, appeared on C-SPAN and BBC, among others. Next to Lynn is Mark Baerbach, who is one of the most distinguished national political reporters in the country. Mark has been covering campaigns for 30 years and has covered elections in 48 of the 50 states, including, I think, this may be an old bio, 7 presidential elections.
You're
behind. Nine.
49 states. I made it to Wyoming 2 weeks ago.
So congratulations. 49. What's the one state?
Rhode Island.
Well, we got to get you there. And has covered the last 9 presidential elections and therefore must be also 9 gubernatorial elections by now or something like that.
Yeah, I have to count.
And Mark began his career with United Press International and now works for the Los Angeles Times out of their San Francisco bureau. Next to Mark is Jennifer Granholm. Jennifer Granholm served as governor of Michigan from 2003 to 2011, during which she worked to diversify the state's economy, strengthen its auto industry, and add new sectors to the state's economic base. She also pushed to double the number of college graduates. And during her tenure, Michigan attracted more than 89,000 clean energy jobs. She was born in Canada, so no, she cannot run for president. But she grew up in Southern California and then came here to Cal for college, so she is an alum. She slummed a little for law school and went to Harvard. Then served as a federal prosecutor, was Michigan's attorney general before being elected governor. Since leaving the governorship, she's been teaching here, where she's a distinguished practitioner of law and public policy at the Goldman School. She co-hosted The War Room with Jennifer Granholm, or she hosted The War Room with Jennifer Granholm on Current TV and co-authored A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future. And at the end, next to Governor Granholm, is Tammy Frisbee, who is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. She studies tax policy both nationally and in the state, and national politics and public policy generally. She's currently working on a book about the politics of tax reform. At Stanford, she teaches courses on American national politics and government and on the politics of policymaking. She previously served as executive director of Stanford's Bill Lane Center for the American West. She, too, has been published widely in many scholarly journals, has contributed to the Wall Street Journal, Politico, CNN, and the Washington Times, among others. So a terrific panel, and since we're a little late, we'll jump right in and get started. So, as I mentioned to the panelists, I think what we'll do is we'll start by talking about the election and then go to sort of the next 4 years and what we might or might not start, what we might or might not expect. So let's go back and talk about the 2012 election, and I wonder if just each of you can talk a little bit about what you think this election represented. Was it an embrace of the president? Was it a rejection of Mitt Romney? Was it a rejection of the Republicans more broadly? Was it a vote for the status quo, since after all the presidency and Congress stayed precisely the same in terms of partisan alignment? What do you think the voters were saying? Lynn, do you want to?
Sure. From my perspective, this is a very typical election result. And when I say that, I mean that a couple of things we know always drive presidential election outcomes. And the first is party identification. If you had to bet who someone's going to vote for, knowing their party would be a very good place to start thinking about how you were going to place that bet. Party identification, a very powerful predictor. The second very important element of a presidential vote is the state of the nation's economy. So not so much how people are doing personally in their finances, but people's assessments of the nation's economy as a whole. And don't believe the hype. In 2012, the economy was growing. It was growing slowly, but it was growing. And there was enough growth there, given the last 60 years of presidential elections. When we look at, well, how much growth does an incumbent party need to get reelected? there was enough growth in 2012 to predict an incumbent party victory. So those two factors alone led me very early on to predict a Democratic Party reelection. And if we drew a regression line through the economic predictions and had nothing else in the model, 2012 would be right on the line. It was exactly where we expected it to be. So I don't think it's a ground shift. There's no game changer here. It was a pretty regular election, but some interesting elements along the way that maybe we'll talk about. And the one that I like to think about is the special constraint that Mitt Romney brought along by being the candidate he was. There a lot of these party identification.
That's a nice way to say that.
Yeah, everybody is somebody, right? So party identification, the economy, those are very robust predictors. But it does matter who the parties nominate in some very interesting ways.
So let's get to some of those later. But Mark, do you want to?
Okay, I would, if I was to sum up the election in one sentence, it would be that good enough was good enough. You know, things weren't great, but they were good enough to reelect Barack Obama. And Lynn talked somewhat about the economy. I thought, and I also have the advantage or disadvantage of putting down thoughts in writing, and so I can say this without fear of contradiction, that I had said throughout the campaign this was going to be a choice. Every election is a choice. Every election is a choice. And it was always going to be a choice at the end of the day between Barack Obama and the alternative. And, you know, the president started out with an enormous advantage structurally. And I'm not talking about the Electoral College. The fact that he did not have a primary challenge. If you go back and you look, candidates who face primary challenges tend to lose. Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Lyndon Johnson didn't even run. Ronald Reagan reelected, Bill Clinton reelected. And we saw that in the course of the primary. Barack Obama was able to basically start out of the center and stay there for most of the campaign. You know, people tend to forget that, you know, what was so damaging to Mitt Romney was this whole, and we'll talk, I'm sure, about the 47% and this perception. People tend to forget that the words vulture capitalist first surfaced in the Republican primary. Rick Perry brought them up. So you know, from the get-go, Barack Obama had certain structural advantages, that being one. The other advantage he had was running against a very poor candidate. I'm sure we'll get into that, too. Mitt Romney was just a bad candidate. We can talk about why that is. I think some of it goes to his conviction and some question about the core of his convictions and what he was doing and saying versus what he may have actually believed in his heart of hearts. So he was a poor candidate. Campaigns and candidates do matter. I mean, with all due respect to the political scientists and the models and all that sort of stuff, campaigns and candidates do matter. And the last point I would make is I think this was an important election, and I'm not going to go out on any kind of limb and make any kind of predictions, but we saw a very significant emergence of a coalition here. We saw the importance of Latinos, young people, women, and I'm sure we're going to get into tonight talking about the future of the parties, and that's something that Republicans need to worry about, because that is an emerging coalition, and they went overwhelmingly Democratic for Barack Obama, and Republicans are going to have to reverse that, or they're going to look at many, many cycles of Democratic presidential victories.
Right. I agree with everything they've just said. But I would also just add this element of the 47% comment. I mean, every election is a choice, but the choice is between somebody, often you want to have it be a choice, who's on my side, which of these two that I'm choosing from is on my side. And the Obama team was really good about being able to say he's on my side and the other guy is not. And the other guy is, not only is he not on my side, but I have no idea who he is. Actually, the Obama team wanted to portray him less as a shapeshifter than as somebody who is really not on your side. But from Michigan, I can just tell you that when Romney came out and said that the auto industry shouldn't receive a bridge loan or a rescue, and his father was the chairman of American Motors, and he came from Michigan, and it was in his DNA. And we all knew when he said that it was completely a putting your finger up in the wind. He was basically denying his heritage, and he stabbed us in the back when we were on our knees. That was such a powerful statement about how desperate he was to become president, rather than a reflection of how he truly believed. At least we saw it that way in Michigan. And so I think that is one little example of him not being on our side and him not being authentic enough for me to believe that he would lead us in a way that would help all of us, you know, most of us anyway.
Well, in the interest of full disclosure, I made the choice in the spring of 2012 to strap myself to the periphery of what Wall Street Journal columnist Peggy Noonan later referred to as the rolling calamity that was the Romney campaign. So my perspective on what happened in the election last year is shaped by that. But my graduate training in political science leads me to agree with what Lynn has shared with us today. Of course, and I think as Lynn has very accurately shared with all of you, that we have this estimate of where we think the election should come out in terms of the president's margin, the incumbent party's margin. And we always thought, from all the models, that this was going to be a very close election. And so there was a possibility for Mitt Romney to have walked away with a victory. But I agree with what has been said here from several perspectives, that if you were going to have headwinds, Mitt Romney was not the candidate in 2012 to pull that off for you. That even when you have an economy that is experiencing slow growth, when that's an economy where the Democrats can say the reason that we are where we are is because of bad behavior in the financial sector, the choice of the Republican Party to put forward a candidate whose entire career has been built in the financial sector struck me early on as bold. So when you just start from that point, you can take all the events of the campaign along the way, and it certainly mattered at various points to varying degrees. But from day one, I agree with Lynn's prediction, and the week before the election, I thought my man was highly unlikely to win.
So the thing that jumps out at me there is there was some, from all of you, I think there was some Romney bashing, and I'll just throw this out, and I want you all to jump in as you want. Don't stand on ceremony. Did Romney's weakness as a candidate make a difference? Could a better Republican candidate have realistically won, or was this sort of baked in the cake?
It would have been hard, but he was a particularly vulnerable candidate because of his background and because every single story that was told was a story of contrast, and he made that contrast against the average citizen so easy to tell. From Bain Capital, the outsourcing of jobs, the Cayman Islands, you name it,
car elevator,
down the list.
What was your thing car at the speech
elevator,
at the convention?
Yeah, Romney's world.
Go ahead.
The elevator and the workers get the shaft. But anyway.
Who wrote that for? Did you write that?
Actually, no. One of the Obama people wrote that for me. It was a great one.
Good line.
Where credit is due.
Yeah. I do think, in retrospect, I mean, look, everything is abundantly clear in retrospect, isn't it? But you do have to wonder what the Republicans were thinking when in the era of the 99%, you know, they nominate one of the most phenomenally wealthy candidates that they ever did. And the governor here touched on something that I think is really significant, and it's authenticity. And I mean, the longer I've done this, the more I've become convinced that, you know, character and a good feeling about someone matters a lot. You know, voters don't go down a checklist and say, check, check, check. You know, it's a gut thing, especially for president. And I think the fundamental problem that Mitt Romney had was a question of authenticity, because I don't think he could be who he was, which I think is fundamentally a devoutly religious man.
Yeah.
And a moderate conservative. And the thing I like in it, too, I mean, look, I love music and snowboarding, and I could sit here and talk all day about resorts and music and this and that, but if you asked me to come up here and pretend every day that I was fascinated with, you know, gardening and, you know, I don't know what, gardening and mystery novels, I mean, I could do it and I could mouth the words, but it would be clear that it was fake, and I think that was fundamentally Mitt Romney's problem. Mitt Romney could not be who Mitt Romney was. Couldn't
run as
Mitt Romney.
That element of fakeness was so the biggest piece of evidence, in addition to the auto industry, was Obamacare. I mean, it was,
Right, as most of you know, RomneyCare was the model for Obamacare. And so here is an accomplishment, good or bad, here was the signal accomplishment of his governorship, which he was running away from. So that, too, goes. He couldn't talk about his faith. He couldn't talk about, you know, his fundamental philosophy. And he couldn't talk about the signal accomplishment of the governorship, which didn't leave a whole lot.
So this is the fundamental weakness for me when I look at the Romney campaign. Unlike Mark, I don't think he was horrible. I think that Mitt Romney was a pretty good candidate. He needed to be exceptional, as the governor said. This was going to be hard from the get-go. You needed an exceptional candidate to beat an incumbent in a slowly growing economy. Romney was okay. He wasn't exceptional.
Could any of those guys win?
None of them that were standing at the end.
And that was the other thing. That was a very weak field that emerged from the first place.
These were
a bunch of world beaters that he went out and, you know.
But the thing is that what he couldn't talk about kind of underscores for me the fact that what he did talk about wasn't good enough. And so, you know, you can't invent messages out of whole cloth. John Kennedy didn't, you know, when he was 8 years old, he didn't say, I want to send a man to the moon, right? That was an opportunity at that time in that election that he and his people saw to take advantage of, you know, popular mood and the culture to shift the conversation of a campaign. And that's what Romney needed to do. He needed to shift the conversation off of the economy. But instead, he focused the campaign on the economy. And so from my perspective, it's a failure of messaging as much as it is a failure of just the constraints that he brought to the table as a candidate.
Look, can I ask a question?
Let Tammy get in on this, because for one thing, she was the person who was hoping for Romney. Poor woman.
Yeah. So I like to shift the perspective just a little bit and say that I agree that the choices that the candidate and the campaign made mattered a great deal, but I think you also have to look at who Mitt Romney was out there on the national stage with. And one of the projects that we engaged in at Stanford and the Hoover Institution was each week we were asking questions about awareness of events in the campaign. And Lynn has been using some of this data, too, through the polling firm YouGov. And early on in the primary, a number of the questions that we asked had to do with what got labeled war on women questions. And we were able to take people's knowledge of those events occurring and then tag them up with who they thought that their candidate choice was in a head-to-head election, the president versus Mitt Romney or any of the other Republican primary contenders when they were still in the race. And we saw, looking at that data, that Mitt Romney was getting a hit among women even when he wasn't the one saying dumb things. And so you could look at the gender gap over time, and in the early part of the year when there's all the discussion about birth control and then Obama coming out with the employer mandate, that series of events, and I'm not even talking right now about the later events related to Todd Akin and Richard Murdoch, but you could see that even when Mitt Romney wasn't the one making the comments, that the gender gap was growing just as large for him as it was growing when you looked at Obama and Rick Santorum, for example. So I think that Mitt Romney ran his own campaign. He was the man standing at the front of the stage. But the Republican brand, I think, arguably hurt him as well.
And so much of that was reinforced by what was going on in the states. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that you've got now 40 states that have anti-choice legislation. It was the Republican governors or the Republican legislators mm-hmm. were completely reinforcing that bad message.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to take over the moderator.
No, go ahead. I can just sit here.
Always the reporter.
You seem to suggest that he shouldn't talk about the economy, but I mean, wasn't that we're coming through the Great Recession and unemployment and all that stuff. So yeah, I mean, how could he not talk about the economy?
Well, if he wanted to win, he had to be talking about something else, right? And
because the economy was improving marginally.
It was. There was slow growth.
But he had nothing else to go on.
Well, he could. Okay, so this is what I wanted to say, right? So you think, we're all talking about the constraints that Romney brings to the table, and so we don't want to make the mistake of hindsight here. So let's just, Mitt Romney comes to your door, and he says, I want to run for president. And what you see is that here's a guy who, saved the Olympics. Okay, is a charitable, gives a lot of money to charity, so he's kind and compassionate. And he is, a part of he's got this American story. His father, working hard to get ahead. His family is a product of the American dream. And you say to yourself, like, what's not to like here, right? And so they, I think, could have told a very American story about him, especially with the Olympics and going over there. I mean, I just thought, wow, this is it. This is where Romney really nails this America. And it was a disaster. But it didn't have to be.
And you think that could have overcome the inherent advantages of an incumbent president running in a slowly growing economy? Could have.
Because.
Yeah.
And this is just a fact. This is not my opinion. This is a fact. One of the attitudes that is most highly correlated with prejudice is patriotism. And so if you prime patriotism, you prime prejudice. And perhaps Mitt Romney wasn't willing to do that, and that would be a good thing. But talking about the being an American and priming those qualities without people knowing also gets them thinking about race.
Although, hang on, although a couple...
That's very distressing.
Well, although
totally
a couple
distressing.
Things, though, too.
To be fair, she's not advocating.
But he did do that to some extent, the whole, you know, I'm not going to apologize for American exceptionalism.
Yes.
I mean, that was sort of a dog whistle, if you will. And the other thing, too, I think, and one thing I can tell you that the campaign was very worried about, I mean, you're right, he gave a tremendous amount and had those very moving stories that they shared at the convention, which got stepped on by Clint Eastwood. We can talk about that. But I can tell you that one of the things they were afraid of talking about, I mean, he has a record of goodness and giving and charity, but their concern was it was all through the Mormon Church,
and they
were afraid.
They didn't want to release the
They
text.
Didn't want to go there, right.
Yeah, and
right.
I think, and so he, his constraints really do make him a tough candidate.
Every one of his positive qualities had a big negative attached to it that he would not have been able to overcome. I honestly think, maybe I'm completely wrong, but I think that someone like Rick Santorum, who had more of a grassrootsy, pro-jobs in America, except for the personal, the very extreme social issues that he took on. I do think that story in the Midwest about pushing for jobs in America would have been a better sell than Mitt Romney's story.
That's interesting. And you don't think the social stuff would have...
No, I think, I carved out the social stuff.
Right.
You can't really do that, I know.
Right.
The economic message was better.
It was a very, very weak field that Mitt Romney struggled. I mean, like I said, this was not
except
a class
for John
of world Huntsman. Beaters.
Huntsman.
Well, who never went anywhere.
Well, though, who but, never went anywhere. Yeah, but I mean, this was a tremendously weak field he emerged from.
Okay, but let's go beyond Romney and beyond the field for just a moment. I want to go back to what Tammy said about the Republican brand.
Yes.
And
yeah.
So does this election?
Fall on you.
You shouldn't have said that. Big mistake. Does this election point to long-term fundamental problems for the Republican Party and therefore long-term fundamental advantages for the Democratic Party?
Yes. Unquestionably.
Can I put an asterisk by that? I would agree with you, yes. No? Although, I've done this long enough to know. I mean, I remember in 1992, I'm not going to mention his name and embarrass him, book came out about, the Republican lock on the White House and the Republican lock, boom, Bill Clinton's elected. Yeah. I have some other people I know wrote a book in 96, same thing, Republican lock, Barack Obama. So I totally agree with you. I mean, if you look at the demographic trends, but I've done this long enough to think that any time we sort of think, assume,
it
doesn't work out that way.
Democracy is not destiny.
Yeah. I don't know.
Okay, somebody have that argument. You think it is destiny, at least to some degree?
I think demography is destiny right now, and unless the Republicans play offense on demography and go after it instead of just playing defense by enacting these voter suppression laws and preventing people from getting to the polls of the classes that they don't like, they got to play offense.
How would they play offense on demography?
Well, so the way
immigration reform.
Yeah, but my concern is from a strategy point of view, playing for the red team, is that right now the plan is we're going to do immigration reform, but you're going to do immigration reform with a Democrat in the White House, and you're going to have to work with Democrats in Congress. So best case scenario, I think you come out with a tie on that.
Yeah. It's better than what they have now, though.
It is better than what they have now, but if you're just at a tie, and then you have to think about, all right, so how are we going to win on other policy issues after that? I don't think the game plan on that has been formed yet, and best case scenario, looking back at the most recent presidential elections, is your border state governor, George W. Bush, winning 40% of the Latino vote, and that is not going to win you the White House, given the growth in the size of the Hispanic population, unless you can figure out how to play that.
Though, they could play offense on millennials. I mean, the millennials went for Obama like 60-something, percent. And
although
it seems to me that young voters, if the right economic arguments are made, or if there's a libertarian strand, there is an opportunity. But they have to be true libertarians. You cannot say that you believe in freedom and then not allow women to have the right to choose, for example. You believe in freedom and you don't want gays to marry. So you can't have it both ways like that.
Right. So this is Rand Paul's hope that he can take advantage of this moving forward, but you just have the RNC meeting in Hollywood here in California voting unanimously against gay marriage. And so the... We are not in a huddle right now, right? Unfortunately, or maybe this will cheer you up, but when I think about this question, I like to think about it this way. We sit here and we think about what's the future of the Republican Party, and we can think about, you know, demography. But I think it's really important to think back to 2000 and to say, okay, it's 2000 and now you're the Democrats. And you're angry and you're thinking about what you're going to do. And really, in 2000 is the thing that you say to you. I look at the governor and I say, Governor, in 8 years, we are going to clean house. We're going to nominate an African-American, and we are going to win this thing so huge the Republicans are going to think that their party is in the dumper forever. Right? No one would have thought that was the way forward. Huh. Right? And so it's tempting to sit here today and say the Republican brand is damaged and they, you know, we don't know how they move forward. But no one would have predicted 2008 and 2012 the way they turned out.
But as we sit here now, we don't see the plan.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know what? If I was a Democrat, and I work for the LA Times, I'm not a Democrat, I'm not a Republican, I'm a nothing. I would be thrilled if Republicans think all they need to do is pass immigration reform and check that box, and Latinos are going to love me. Because I'll tell you a couple things. Number one, health care. If you look at the numbers, Latinos overwhelmingly support Obamacare. Okay. Something else, you know, call it symbolism, call it imagery. Do Republicans really want to go out and pick a fight, you know, and go after the Latino that Obama's trying to put in his cabinet, the civil rights guy who did all this stuff? I mean, I'm hearing this stuff this morning. I mean, you know, these things send messages, and it's not just passing immigration reform. It's stuff like that, which is going to hurt them. And believe me, if you don't believe me, watch Telemundo and see how they cover these stories and see what Latino voters are taking in on this thing. And again, it's not just immigration. It's social policy. It's health care. It is a whole range of issues.
And if you listen to Marco Rubio, who's in the center of negotiating this weekend on Meet the Press and all of these others, he was so harsh about the immigration reform bill that he's negotiating in terms of how long this path to citizenship will be. You have to wait 10 years before you can even apply to citizenship, and in the normal course of things, it takes another 5 years to become a citizen. So 15 years is the pathway, in addition to fines, in addition to not being eligible for any services during that period of time. It doesn't sound like a very inviting path.
I want to come back to immigration reform, but one more question on the 2012 election before we go to what's going to happen, which is, so we've talked about Republican brand damaging, maybe permanently or not, but damaging Mitt Romney, not a very good candidate. So I imagine if Barack Obama were sitting here, he might say, hey, I had something to do with this. So did the president run a good campaign? Is he a good candidate? I think, Lynn, why don't you start? Because I think some of your research suggests that people, despite all these comments about he's aloof or he's cold or whatever, people actually like the guy, right?
Yes. People like Barack Obama, and they liked him personally much more than they liked Mitt Romney. I think in 2008, he really ran a fabulous campaign, one of the best in modern history. I think in 2012, he ran a good campaign. He was structurally advantaged, as Mark said, in a number of ways, and he didn't do anything to blow that, which in my terms is a good campaign. And he does have this great ability to connect to people while he's out there. He clearly loves the mass audience. It brings out the authenticity in him that we've talked about that Mitt Romney didn't have. And I can sit here and talk about all of this because it's what I love. It's what I love about politics. But at the end of the day, I do have to tell you that it's very, very hard for us to find that any of these kinds of very subtle things make a big difference.
The things that make a big difference are the things I talked about in the beginning. Party identification, the state of the economy, things like Barack Obama connecting with you are things that matter at the margin. Now, sometimes that margin is pivotal, and certainly a lot of things that matter only at the margin and up to perhaps 2 points, which can swing an election. But we're really talking about stuff mattering on the edges.
I think, you know, to be elected president, you have to be a good campaigner and a good candidate. Barack Obama's not a great campaigner. I mean, I would say the single best campaigner, pure campaigner I've ever covered is Bill Clinton, who's just amazing. It was like, you know, I was like Secretariat down the backstretch or Sandy Koufax pitching. I mean, it was like the master. It was something to be seen. So, you know, yes, he's good, but I want to say something about his campaign. I mean, they ran a brilliant campaign in terms of outreach, in terms of structure. And one thing really stays with me. I did some reporting on a Get Out the Vote story at the end of the campaign, and I happened to be stuck by Sandy. I was stranded in Boulder, and I was talking to someone in Colorado, and this really struck with me because I was talking to both sides, and the Republicans were talking about, well, we've rung on this many doorbells and handed out this many flyers and yada, 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 yada. And then I was talking to the Obama people, and this woman told me about this one woman. They had broken down to such a level that they had people who were responsible for individual blocks. And she told me about how she had lived in this community for like 8 or 9 months so that when she knocked on the door, like she would knock on a voter's door and like the little kids would run out and hug her and say, oh, she's back. You know, in other words, the point being, what the Obama people did that was so effective was, it's one thing for like, hi, I'm random person from the Romney campaign calling you, remind you. You know, it's something else when your neighbor, Claire from next door is coming over. You know what I mean? And the Obama campaign did just such a remarkable job in terms of getting the vote out and really getting into communities. And it's the final sort of thing. I mean, Republicans made a lot of sport of Obama and the community organizer, but the community organizer went out and kicked the butt of the corporate rich guy.
Do you want to, Governor?
I can't
the Obama campaign?
Obviously, I'm a little biased on it, but I campaigned for the president in a couple of the battleground states in Virginia and in Florida, and what they would do is every day, they had block captains for every single key community, targeted community, and they would come back and they would do their rounds. They would report in every night. It was a machine. Everything got fed back in this very detailed, granular, technology-driven system, and they knew who was showing up on election day. It was incredible. They knew exactly by the hour who had shown up of the people they had targeted, which was everybody, who hadn't shown up, who needed a ride, what time they said they were going to go. They had deployed this. It was an army the likes of which I don't think, I know that I've never seen. It was an incredible operation, both digitally as well as boots on the ground.
Yeah. Can I just say, though, that this is not what won the election for Barack Obama. So, everyone likes to talk about how many doors they knocked on. And when I was in Colorado and a gentleman said this in a forum like this, I calculated how many people lived in Colorado. We think the effectiveness is maybe somewhere 3, 4, 5, maybe 8 percentage points if you knock on someone's door that changes their vote calculation. And it's just impossible. In a lot of states, it's impossible to have moved the vote enough to have changed the outcome. And if we look at all the counties where Obama had field offices, and if I asked you guys to guess the difference in the voting rate for Obama between the counties where he had field offices and the counties where he didn't, what would you say? You, in your head, think about what you think the average difference in Obama's vote share is. Places where he had field offices mobilizing people in neighborhoods like this and not. Okay. The result is a half a percentage point.
Can I ask a question? Are we comparing parts of Ohio versus parts of Ohio? Are we comparing like parts of Ohio versus like South Dakota, where they basically said, forget it?
You can do it both ways. So we're not comparing at all. We're just saying, Barack Obama, put your field offices where you want to put them, and Mitt Romney, put your field offices where you want to put them, and let's just see where these places are, if there's a higher vote share.
But they're saturating the places that they are targeting. So what would they have been without those? You would have compared them. I think it would have been a lot less because of that. I mean, granted, all of these efforts are on the margins, but that's where elections are won.
Yeah,
and I think that's
no,
true.
I think that's exactly right.
But so adding the boots on the ground and his focus on the right demographics and making sure their outreach targeted in that way, and their focus on women, Latinos, gays, people who African Americans, obviously all of that adds up to some percentage. He ended up winning 55-45. It was all because of that, right?
I think that's just the thing I wanted people to come away with, is that when you say it was incredible and it was formidable, and there are a lot of headlines like that. I asked people once this question, and someone said they thought the average difference would be 8 points or 10 points. And it's not. It's a very small number. But, as I said, this is a small number, and the other thing produces a small shift, and another thing produces a small shift, and pretty soon you're at 3 or 4 percentage points.
You only need one.
But isn't the sort of the thrust of the story of this election that, and I realize I'm the one who asked about Obama, but that Obama didn't have to... The default position, given an incumbent in a slowly growing economy, was an Obama victory. So Obama didn't really have to change anything. It would have been the case that Romney would have had to change a sufficient number of marginal things to create a different outcome.
I question this, because I think the perception out there that the Romney people were really great at creating the perception that even though the economy was growing slightly, that it was not growing. They put out ad after ad that caused people, if you ask people, is the economy on the right track, they absolutely would have said no.
You know what, can I...
Lynn, do you know the data?
I have data.
What did people say about the economy?
No,
Mark has data.
Surprising, I know, because I usually write my stories just kind of pull it out of the air, but I have data for this one. No, because I thought this was interesting and significant. And I'm doing this based on the exit polls. That 6 in 10 voters in the exit polls said the economy was their top concern. 4 in 10 believed that the economy was getting better. But to me, the salient, to use a political science term, salient thing is that just about half people blamed Bush and not Obama for the economy. I think that was significant. So people might have thought, good enough was good enough, it was improving, but I think a lot of people didn't blame Obama for the economy.
Yeah, so two things quickly about this. One of the weird things about this relationship between the change in economic growth and incumbent parties' reelection rates is that the relationship works best with the objective economic indicator. So you go get the GDP numbers from, the government. When you start looking at people's opinions, it gets messy because people's opinions are correlated with their party identification. You think the economy is growing? Your answer to that question depends a lot on whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. Okay, and I want to give a shout out to Professor Gabe Lenz, who's standing in the back of the room, and he is the person who works on this more than anybody in the country. And that matters a lot, your party identification. So the objective indicator is not colored by partisanship. But here's where the Romney campaign, I think, made a critical error. They wanted to live by public opinion. They looked at those numbers that Mark just talked about, and they said, people don't think the economy's getting better. They don't believe it. So we've got this locked up, and if we hammer home on this message, we will win. But the problem is, if you live by public opinion, you have to be ready to die by it. And they didn't do what Mark just did and look at the next question in the survey, which is, who do you blame for that? And the answer to that was George Bush. And they didn't take public opinion in its entirety into account. And that's ultimately, I think, their failure.
I want to move off the election, but I also want to give Tammy a chance, if she wants to comment on this, what the Romney campaign did?
Well, maybe just a comment about the Romney poll debacle, because that's gotten a fair bit of attention. It turns out that, in fact, they did believe that they were going to win. That was not just a public statement they were making, talking to people more in the inner sanctum of the campaign. That was a very unpleasant surprise to them on election night. And they really believed that turnout, especially among Latinos, was going to be more like their projection than the Obama administration projection. And it just flabbergasts me why you wouldn't run a conservative, as a Republican, campaign and run your campaign as if you were going to have the Obama turnout projections, not your own more favorable ones, and then see what you could make happen on the ground game. They claim that they were more resource constrained than they actually were. I don't understand how you can have a $1 billion campaign and be resource constrained, but that's what I'm hearing.
Who were they listening to? Who was doing the polling?
Everybody
else knew.
Well, Neil Newhouse. Remember that name?
Well, how did they even know that?
Well, so Neil Newhouse was their pollster, and I try to be fair to Neil. I don't know him well. I've met him, and I do think that he was very upfront about what his assumptions were, and the core assumption that caused the problem for them in understanding what was going to happen on election night was this issue of what turnout among minorities was projected to be. Mm-hmm. And they thought it was going to be much less than the Obama campaign projected it to be, and guess who turned out to be right?
Well, and then the thing too, I mean, look,
quickly, because I want to move on.
You can
off
spend
election.
Whole hours talking about polling, but you know, the stuff is, I mean, polling is as much art as it is science, and it, the best polling is an educated guess, and they were guessing that, you know, the dial up, you dial down the numbers, and they were dialing way up the white turnout and way down the Latino turnout, and that's how you come up with these numbers.
Let's move off the election and move on to sort of the next 4 years. So I mentioned that in one way this was a status quo election, that Democratic president, Congress stays the same partisan alignment. So is there any reason that we should expect something different in the sense of how Washington works? Whatever that issue is it a grand bargain on fiscal issues or immigration reform or gun control, should we expect anything different to happen, or given the partisan alignment and given the inherent bias of the American system toward inaction on domestic policy, should we expect not a lot to happen? Is the system so biased toward nothing happening that...
I think, Governor, if you look right now at the debate right now over background checks on guns, where 91% of Americans think this is a good idea, more people believe that there should be background checks for guns than believe in God. More people believe, I am not kidding you, it's 89% for believe in God. It's 85% for people who like Italian food. More people believe there should be background checks than people who like kittens. And yet, we are still seeing this huge, something will happen in the Senate, thank God for Manchin and Toomey, but it's going to die in the House. What's going to happen is that little example is one example that the president will be able to take to the country in 2014 and say, give me people I can work with. Give me people who are reasonable. Give me people who will not sign pledges. Give me people who will compromise.
Okay, but that, and so you're the absent the 2014 election, your answer, unfortunately and pessimistically, is you don't think anything will really happen.
Well, I'm hopeful because I'm American. I want to see something happen. But as of this moment, based upon what we're seeing in the past couple of weeks.
Yeah. I'm generally concerned about the prospect of getting policy actually made. But the hope that I hold out, and I think that the wild card here that a lot of people are underestimating is John Boehner. And I think that as we approach 2014, especially if John Boehner feels like he's going to lose his speakership anyway because the Democrats are going to pull this off and retake the House, which is, I think, highly unlikely. But that ups the odds dramatically of what I'm about to suggest happening. But I think even short of that, I think John Boehner is a man who considers himself first and foremost a statesman. And my read on the situation, and it's not a very social scientific-y read, but here's my gut, is that John Boehner wants to cut a deal, that he wants a grand bargain, and that the tighter that the right flank of the Republican conference in the House pulls on his reins and tries to keep him from making a deal, the more likely he is at the end of the day to say, you know what, I don't want to be Speaker of the House if I can't get anything done. And he'll walk over to the White House, and he'll reach a grand bargain with the president. He's already proven himself willing to violate something called the Hastert Rule, which is a norm that in the House of Representatives you don't pass legislation unless it can get the majority of the majority party.
John Boehner has passed a couple of things, even just in the last 6 months, in which he's violated the Hastert rule. I think he's willing to cut a deal with the president that could make it through the Senate and that would pass the House using all the Democrats and some of the Republicans, and that he will walk out of that Capitol building smoking a cigarette and giving that place the bird. That is my bet on this, on moving forward.
From your mouth to God's ears.
So that's predicated on the notion that there are enough Republicans who don't fear primaries or whatever, who would obviously
it
would have to pass with the majority, with the substantial majority of Democrats. You think there would be enough Republicans to push it through?
I think the math is tight, but I think that I think this is a long shot, right? And I'm engaging in a lot of conjecture here. But I think it's possible, yeah.
See, I mean, and fundamentally, that's sort of where we stand right now politically. And it's not good, it's not bad. It may be good or bad. I'm just saying it is what it is. You know, right now, for most members of both parties, the greatest concern is being defeated in a primary. Mm-hmm. It's not being defeated in a general election. And so your impetus, your survival mode, if you will, is to appease the base of your party, because that's the greatest threat you face. And so that's why we have senators who represent entire states moving in a direction that House members who are representing a very small, very homogenous district aren't willing to go. So that's why we're seeing the White House and the Senate coming to terms on something and likely dying in the House.
I'm curious, do you think that's true, I think, in a large number, especially in the very, very conservative districts in the House. But don't they risk appealing to the even smaller slice of super base voters in a district that actually may be slightly more reasonable than you give them credit for? Like districts that might favor background checks by 55% rather than 91%, but ultimately people think it's rational.
Well, you know, what you get... Wow, you brought that, that one.
I have a feeling that someone just leaned against a light switch back there, so hopefully we'll...
Oh, there we go.
Figure that
well,
out.
Yes, but I think I think to answer that question,
it's a tea partier.
See, I think that if you look at districts, you will find, and I'm going to use an example, but I'm not going to have actual numbers from the district. But an example. I was in Aurora, Colorado, a month or so ago, doing a story on a guy, Mike Coffin. There's 16 Republican members who are in districts that Obama won, in the whole country, 16. He's one of them. And, here's a guy who has been moving to that district. He ran, used to brag about his A-plus rating from the NRA. Well, he doesn't talk about that anymore. But the point being that I think if you were to take a poll in that district, you would probably find that, yes, there's substantial support overall in that district for background checks. But if you took a poll of Republicans in that district, you'd find the numbers falling quite a bit. And again, these guys and gals are less concerned about the whole district as opposed to the minority of the minority within their district. The 20 or 30% of the members of their party who are going to either even bother to vote in a primary, who, as you know, on both sides tend to be the most motivated, and ideological. So I think that, yes, while there is maybe that broad view within the district, these people are focused on the minority of the minority, basically the base of their party, and they're afraid of getting primaried and losing.
One of the things that's always interesting to me about this argument about primaries is that when we think about the general election and we talk about the great ground game and registering and getting voters out, I'm just waiting for the day when that all trickles down to the primaries. We seem to just kind of say, like, oh, well, only those most committed, most extreme ideological people turn out in the primaries, and so, of course we get the Tea Party. But, where are all our great GOTV people in the primaries? Like, let's go register some moderates and get them to actually turn out in primaries. And this is one of my hobby horses is we don't spend enough time thinking about how people enter politics. And I think we have to do a much better job of recruiting people to think about becoming politicians. It's just tremendous to me that young people don't think about this anymore as something they would want to do. And I think that's a real problem. And I just really feel like a lot of this that's happening in the primaries is damaging to the system
for sure.
In ways that we don't really even think about.
I agree with you, but let's say we're sitting here doing a cold calculated cost-benefit analysis, and I need to spend, you know, $10 to get this guy who's sort of casually interested in politics, but, you know, his kid's got a soccer game, he's got a dentist appointment, he doesn't know if he wants to vote or not, or I can spend, you know, $10 to get her, him, these people who are diehard pro-gun or pro-life or anti-war or whatever. You know what I mean? As a cost-benefit analysis, if my calculation is winning an election, I'm going to spend the $10 to get these ideological people out as opposed to $10 to try and get this guy who's also thinking about the soccer game to come to the polls.
Which is why I think what's happening in California with these jungle primaries gives potentially some great hope if it can be a model that could spread across the country, because I do think you will end up seeing many more reasonable, centered candidates emerging.
Okay, but before we get too far onto California, I want to get back to the president before we go down the road of California, which is endless. You want to quickly?
No.
Okay. No. And one note, which is that if you have questions, please write them out and pass them to the end of the aisle. Someone will come by and pick up those cards, or you can just hold up your card, and someone will collect them, and they'll be brought up to me. And we'll get to questions in a bit. Let's talk about how the president may govern. So he's clearly pushing hard on gun control. That's clearly a key issue. I think it's less clear how hard he will push on immigration control. I think, although maybe Tammy wants to disagree with me, it's less clear how hard he would really push for a grand bargain of some sort, maybe dependent on what the speaker does or what. So what do we expect the president to make as the centerpiece of his second term? I think the centerpiece of the first term clearly was Obamacare. Is the centerpiece of the second term gun control, which is kind of an unusual issue to make the centerpiece of a term? Is the centerpiece of the second term just cementing implementation of Obamacare, this historic legacy? What's the focal point of the second term?
I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, first of all, the gun issue is a reaction to circumstances out there. So that wasn't his, but he's certainly going to champion it. I think immigration reform will be a centerpiece. He will absolutely push that very hard. He believes in it. It's good for the economy. That's, I think, something that is going to happen. I do think his focus on the economy, both large and small, is going to continue to be a centerpiece. So that might mean a grand bargain that he will continue to push for. The budget shows that he was willing to push for a grand bargain. The fact that he included this, the entitlements, the change CPI in his budget tells you he wants to do a deal. I mean, just in the same way that Boehner wants to do a deal. Whether he could do it with some folks who are actually willing to raise enough money to invest in the country, I don't know. But I do think his proposals to invest in research, to invest in energy, although I don't think we're going to see anything on energy in the second term because of the composition, at least currently, of the House, unfortunately. I hope his ability to push through an infrastructure bank or some infrastructure investment that would allow for us to be able to put people to work, those pieces, I think, are all pieces that he will continue to push for. But I do think that he would love to see a restructuring of the tax code.
Well, and can I build on that? And here, I'm wading into policy, so both of you can bail me out. I mean, as I said to Tammy on the way over here, I cover politics, I don't cover substance. But I'm going to venture here and try and, like I said, bail me out here. I think the budget document he put out last week is very interesting and could speak to what could be sort of the fundamental thing. I think, yes, cementing Obamacare would be a part. But if you look at that budget, it makes a very interesting calculation or puts on the table a very interesting notion, and that is that if you look at our government and the way spending has trended over the last couple decades or so, the Urban Institute, nonpartisan, found that, you know, $7 for every dollar that is spent on children, we spend $7 on old folks, to use a colloquial term. What he's proposed with this whole chain CPI, and for the, you know, non-political, you know, basically it's just a way of calculating Social Security benefits so elderly retirees would get less money. They would get less money. They would kick in more for Medicare. And what he's trying to do is this sort of generational transformation, if you will, transfer. Yes. What he's trying to do is sort of bring it back and invest in things like college aid, early child care, things that pay off for the millennials and younger people and take some of this money away that we're spending on older people. And I think if that's part of a grand bargain or something, we could look back at Obama, if there is some significant legacy, if this happens, I think that could be it. It could be this transfer of wealth, of spending, or of policy oriented away somewhat from older people and more toward younger people and up-and-coming generations.
Tammy, you look like you want to...
I agree with that, but I think that requires the president making a real commitment to change the conversation, the dominant narrative about what the inequality problem in this country is. That's going to be, I think, difficult for him to do politically, that he needs to make this shift to say it's about inequality across generations. It's about robbing from your children and your grandchildren to continue a system that cannot be paid for, and that trying to use that very powerful language of inequality that has gotten him so far to this point would be a way to do that. But so sort of maybe finally come to the point in the evening where I say something negative about the president, I think that the problem that we've had with the president is that while, yes, the Republicans, I will admit, have been less than cooperative in Congress, I think that the president has not exercised the kind of bully pulpiting that we would have needed to from the beginning, like 2009, on this. And I understand that there were some circumstances that were distractions for him. But repeatedly, when he's come out with these budgets, why is this the first time, the first budget, that we've had the change CPI?
Well, do you think it's because he's not running for re-election again, and so he's freed
up?
Well,
certainly, right. So, yeah, now, because there's a lot of the base, the Democratic base, that is unhappy with this change CPI proposal. So certainly that's part of it. But
from a political point of view, though,
yeah.
I mean, just from a pure politics, mm-hmm. he puts out this change CPI. I mean, you know that he's obviously offered that behind mm-hmm. the scenes to John Boehner. Mm-hmm. It was part of the conversation they had around a grand bargain. But in doing this, as well as putting the investments in that budget, it shows that he's being balanced. Now, the Republicans are going to walk away from it because he's asking for changes in the tax code mm-hmm. for those who are investors. And when they say that they won't do that, even if they get what they've been clamoring for, which is this change CPI, yeah. again, from a purely political point of view, he paints them as being yeah. unwilling to compromise and unreasonable. And he's the reasonable mm-hmm. one. He's willing to anger his base even to get something to move the country forward. Mm-hmm. I think that's a strategy that could be very effective for him.
Right. Well, it is a strategy, right? So
then
you can say, well, then he actually isn't serious about the change CPI proposal because he knows the Republicans won't take it, and therefore he's not serious about real reform.
Yeah, but then what you would say is the only time he's serious is if he puts out change CPI without a balance on the revenue side, right. And that's just the Republican position. No.
I was surprised. I threw this out earlier, and I was surprised that Lynn or Tammy didn't jump on this. That's a political science kind of point. That the system is inherently biased towards inaction, right? That domestic policy really rarely happens.
Yep.
Talk about that a little bit.
By design,
and then particularly when you add in the growth of the filibuster through the years, and the fact that now in the last 40 years you have to have 60 votes.
I guess what I was going to say when you raised that the first time is just, I wanted to say something about the Tea Party, actually.
Okay.
Only because, you know, we talked so much about them for the last several years, and I think that they're done. I really think that their prime has ended. And I think all the things that were said about Boehner are spot on. I'm from Ohio, and I've known him for a long time. And you know, he and Obama strangely find themselves, you know, a little bit in the same place. Like, they both have legacies that they're thinking about. And, you know, Boehner has just really gotten, he's just gotten beat up. And I'm sure that he would like to not be beat up at the end of the day. And so I think that there are lots of things happening now that lead me to believe that we've seen the end of the obstructionist. When I say the Tea Party, I mean the obstructionist part of it. The, you know, line in the sand where Boehner says, get your butts in line.
You
and they
you
say,
think that they're going to cooperate now?
I think they're...
They've got to be moved out, though, don't they?
Well, so that would be good, right, in terms of making progress now. Like, if we're talking about not our partisan preferences, but how are we going to make progress toward policy? You know, these guys held things up that their party caucus wanted to do. And so, you know, yes, get them out, or they now have to play in the party caucus. And I think that the indications are they're starting to do that. They're not so much caucusing separately anymore and all these kinds of things. And so, you know, I see that all as a good sign. Whether that means that we can overcome the fundamental hurdle of the way our government is designed to maintain the status quo, I don't think so. I mean,
do you think that this shift that you've described, and I hope you're right, but does it signal the waning of Grover Norquist's influence?
It's hard for me to tell because something else that you said I think is really important. Earlier, the governor said that, you know, people want these things, 91%, you know, want the background check. And almost everybody will tell you they'd prefer their member of Congress compromise to get things done instead of draw a line in the sand to stand on principle. And so there's all of this going on in the public that I'm just not sure whether this is just finally people realizing that if we don't do this, if we don't give a little bit and compromise, we're really going to alienate our constituents. And I just don't know. We don't have a lot of data on that.
So, I'm curious what Tammy thinks about this softening of the Tea Party idea.
Well, and to not hold out my partisans as virtues of compromise and democratic action, I think you're referring to the YouGov poll, right, Lynn, where they ask if you could choose
a congressman
who sticks to their principles or compromises to get things done, which would you prefer? Member of Congress. And you look at that by party breakdown, Democrats are much more likely than Republicans to prefer somebody who compromises to get things done than Republicans are. Republicans want somebody who sticks to their principles. That partisan gap narrows somewhat if you ask a more specific version of the question. We asked a version of the question that was centered around the expiration of the Bush-Obama tax cuts at the end of 2012. Basically, do you want somebody who sticks to their principles and lets tax rates rise for everybody, or somebody who's willing to compromise? And that narrows it somewhat, but Republicans are still more likely to want somebody who sticks to their guns. So I would like what you suggest to be so, just so we could actually get some policy made. But I'm a little bit worried.
Well, Mark, you've covered the Tea Party.
I just want to inject first of all, a necessary corrective. I mean, the Tea Party is sort of a misnomer. Basically, these are Republicans who don't want to identify as Republicans because they didn't like Bush or what he did or how he raised the deficit. I mean, I was on it was something, it was like an interview, and they had a Tea Party person who was basically talking about us and our, referring to Romney, and the Republicans. I mean, again, these Tea Party were people who, for whatever reason, did not want to identify themselves as Republicans because they were disgusted with the party. I mean, you can look at how they voted, 90-some or whatever percent were Republicans. You know, the other thing, too, is I'm always somewhat dubious about these, you know, motherhood and apple pie polls. You know, I want my congressman to do what's right. Just stand by the principles as long as they're my principles. You know what I mean? People are great for sticking to your guns, but you know, they want you to stick with the guns that are your guns, and they want you to stick the principles that you believe in. And it's great in the abstract sense that, yes, you want someone to compromise, but I think that tends to break down when you get into very specific things and how they're going to act on issues, as opposed to sort of the vague notion of you know, why can't everyone get together and get things done? I mean, how many times have I heard that talking to people? And it's necessarily, it goes back to your question. You know, they can't get things done because it is supposed to be difficult and it is supposed to be hard.
Mm-hmm. Well, to the governor's question about Grover Norquist. So let's let Grover Norquist's actions speak for him. And, of course, Grover Norquist has gotten mostly Republican members of Congress and almost all of them to sign his taxpayer protection pledge, in which he makes them say that they will not raise taxes under any circumstances without offsets. And he is now turning his attention to the states because he thinks that he has largely lost the battle in D.C. I think he feels that is slipping away. So that could be a way in which we might see some policy motion in D.C., but then I think that things might get very interesting in the states.
I totally agree with you. I think so much is happening in the states that's all beneath the surface of what you do not hear. We don't have enough reporters in the states covering state governments. Huge amount of legislation being crafted by folks allied with Grover Norquist through something called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Mm-hmm. It's essentially a bill mill that invites largely Republicans. They say they're bipartisan, but really it's a Republican effort. And they give bills to Republican state legislators to pass through these state houses. For example, so many of the voter suppression bills, the bills that a lot of this is funded, for example, by the Koch brothers. I'm sure many of you are aware. And so there's a lot of anti-renewable energy pushes happening in the state governments now to take away renewable portfolio standards, for example, a commitment that the state makes to get its energy from clean sources because the Koch brothers are largely oil and gas people. So the bottom line is huge effort happening at the state level that I think is really going to be the next wave or opportunity, however you want to look at it, for conservative legislation.
Can I just circle back real quickly? Look, this isn't voodoo, and it's not witchcraft. You know, politicians, there's no organism on the planet that is more responsive to heat and light than a politician. And the day that politicians start losing office because they're extreme and they will not compromise is the day that they will start compromising and responding. It's that simple.
Let's answer a few questions from the audience. Governor, and this is... follows up on you were just talking about energy policy in the states, but this is a question about national energy policy. You mentioned this briefly earlier, but given the well-publicized failure of Solyndra and the departure of Stephen Chu, have the prospects for major progress in national energy policy diminished in the second term?
Yeah, I mean, they were diminished after 2010 when the Republicans took over the House and they started to call cap and trade, cap and tax, and they really were successful in reframing the energy policy. The challenge on this, I think, is that the U.S. ends up being stagnant on this, whereas and we're going to continue to see these extreme weather events. It's only when the extreme weather events really start to accelerate that I think it will penetrate into the consciousness of everyday citizens that we've got to do something. Without that and without a change in the House, I don't see we're going to see any national energy policy. Unfortunately, I wish we were. And if we do, it has to be framed as a jobs policy.
Mm-hmm. This is a question that sort of goes to a broader issue, I think, that has come up vaguely, but not really. Should the president push for repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act? So I guess I'll broaden that and say, what is the... And we don't know what the Supreme Court will do, of course, and that could decide the issue. But leaving the court to one side for a moment, how does the whole gay marriage issue, both in the states and the Defense of Marriage Act, how does that play out politically over the next few years for both parties? Mark, do you want to?
I think it becomes, in time, a non-issue. I'll tell you very quickly a story that I thought was very, very telling. You know, my daughters are both in college now, but we would talk about political issues, and I made a point of not saying this is good, this is bad. I want them to think about things. So one time, this was in 2008 when Prop 8 was on the ballot, we talked about gay marriage, and I said, this is what one side says, this is what the other side says, what do you think? And you know what they did? They looked at me, they're like, whatever. Who even cares? I mean, I think over time it is going to become a non-issue. In the same way that people of my generation, it's like, you know, a black man wants to marry a white woman or vice versa, it's like, why is that even, who cares? I think we're going to get to that point. I think it will become, in time, a non-issue. I think gay marriage will probably become the law of the land in some fashion. There'll be some holdouts. But even more than that, I think it will become a non-issue.
And that suggests that for it to become a non-political issue, the Republican Party will have to change its position sufficiently that they won't have a millstone around their neck.
Well, I think it does tend to alienate younger people, you know, like my daughters who are just like, it's like, who cares? Why are you even talking about this kind of stuff? I think it is a millstone.
Well, and so as we approach 2016, this will be a real moment of reckoning for the Republicans, because my guess is that given the acceleration that we've had on acceptance of gay marriage over just the last, say, even year, that by the time we approach the end of 2014, the beginning of 2015, so the campaign in earnest, that It's possible that outside the Deep South, this issue will largely be settled at the state level. And if so, the Republicans are going to have a choice to make whether to nominate a candidate for the general election who is going to say, I accept gay marriage, I accept what is happening in the majority of the states, or they're going to nominate Rick Santorum, who will then, you know, take a firm position on that issue, appeal to his base, and at that point, I think, I mean, just looking at the data, you cannot win the White House with just social conservatives, not passing a judgment on, you know, that particular policy stance. But, I mean, what it is, it's a political party, as I, you know, mentioned at dinner, throwing gasoline on itself and lighting itself on fire. So, you know, at least in the short term.
Not passing a judgment on it.
I mean, you can think lots of policies are good ideas, but politically, right?
Politically, right.
And, you know, I want to be clear, too. I'm not advocating what the president should or shouldn't do or whether gay marriage is good or bad. I just want to be clear that I'm not taking a position on the issue.
I am. And, I think that it is really, I mean, if you know, far be it for me to give advice to the Republicans, but, I really think this issue, I mean, the log cabin Republicans, God bless them for sticking around the Republican Party that continues to shut its door on their freedom. It seems crazy. But that and the effort to try to shut the door on others, I think, is just going to really kill the Republican Party. And maybe it takes another election for them to get that wake-up call and be really clear. I mean, if in 2016, you know, Hillary Clinton is the nominee, I think that whoever the Republicans put up, will be a loss. But that would be a long time outside of the White House, a long time to recalibrate and get their act together, and then they would really have an opportunity in, 2020.
I just want to sort of, take everyone back to where we started, which is just to say that if the economy tanks, the social issues will be less relevant. And people will vote for Republicans, and they will win the White House in 2016. That would be that. If you were a betting person, if the economy starts to slack off, that's your safest bet. And so, it's in a lot of ways, it's really rewarding to think about progress in this way. You know, how are we going to change as a country moving forward? How will we leave things better, for our children and whatever that means to you? But at the end of the day, I love what Mark said about there's no organism more responsive to heat and light than a politician. But voters are so responsive to the state of the economy. And, that sets the context for all of these presidential elections. And so, again, I just say that a lot of the real hard work of politics, I think, has to happen at the super local level. And you've got to go back into your communities and do your best to get really great people to start running for local office so they come up through the party system and someday can be governor and president.
But this argument, though, about the economy plays into the hands of the party that actually has solutions. Part of the problem is the hollowing out of the middle class and this huge income disparity. Who has got the solutions that will address those problems to allow for there to be opportunity in the country? And even if the economy is going in the wrong direction, if it's perceived that one party is blocking some of those solutions, whether it's the legislature, in the case of President Obama, if the economy is tanked by 20, in the next election, the next presidential election, just say, if the economy is tanked by then he can say, the legislature would not allow me to implement the solutions that were necessary for us to lift our boats. Now, it will be a tougher argument, granted, but you'll have a new candidate, too. I just don't think the economy, without all other things being equal, there are solutions that are out there that are, if they're being blocked, then people will give you a little more, movement.
I wasn't even going to bring up 2016, but since a couple of you have asked about it and there's a question about it, let's talk about that. Many think 2012 was a realigning election. I assume that's a reference to the sort of underlying demographic issues that will be confirmed by a Hillary candidacy and election in 2016. What do you think? Who wants to take on? Is Hillary going to run? Will she win? And will it mean that this is a long-term deficit for the disadvantage for the Republican Party?
Yes, 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 no.
Yes, yes, yes.
Wow, those are short answers. Okay.
I tell you what, I have taken a solemn oath not to write any 2016 stories. I'm not engaging in speculation. I will simply say this. If I had come here in 2005 and sat on the stage and said, you know what, Democrats are going to win the White House, and they're going to win states like Indiana and Virginia and North Carolina. They haven't won in 40, almost 50 years, and they're going to do it with a black guy with an Arabic name who just moved to Washington. I would not have been invited back for the 2006 panel, 2007 panel. So I make no predictions.
All right, so we have a yes, yes, no, a yes, 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 and a chicken. Tammy, do you want to weigh in on 2016 in any way, shape, or form?
I think that the prospect of a Hillary candidacy should make the Republicans very nervous. I think that she taps into many of the central problems that the Republicans had, both as an out party trying to run against an incumbent in an economy that wasn't great, but actually wasn't that terrible, in that she can hearken back to Bill, just as Obama did during the Democratic National Convention. And also, the women issues are going to be front and center. And so the question is, if you are running yet another slate of men, even if you have Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and Bobby Jindal in there, how is that going to work out for you? And you know, right now, Susana Martinez, I think, is somebody who could potentially
the governor of New Mexico.
Governor of Mexico could potentially be an interesting choice to run against Hillary. I hear that she is actually not that enamored with the prospect of actually having to run for president. So I think that we might end up with a stage full of dudes and against Hillary Clinton. And
although, you know, can I interject something? You were at the other end of the table. We were talking about this at lunch, at dinner. One thing I would not underestimate, and I want to be clear, I'm not saying this is an impediment. This would keep either Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton out of the White House. But I think it is a hurdle they would have to deal with. Mm-hmm. And that is this whole notion, this dynastic notion. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you from having gone all over the country in 2007 and 2008, how many people back then didn't really like the idea about Hillary Clinton running after her husband had been president? And it may not be fair to Jeb Bush, it may not be fair to Hillary Clinton, but that's something I have to deal with. It's just this built-in notion that, you know, America is, we like to think, a meritocracy. It's not a dynastic society. And that is something that Hillary will have to deal with if she runs. It's something that Jeb Bush will have to deal with if he runs.
I think it's less than in 2008, number one. And number two, dynasties are often referred to as sons of fathers. As a woman, I think it's less of a taint for her than it would be for Jeb Bush. Besides two Bushes, you know, plus a third, that's just...
Two is okay, three is four too many. Yeah.
But I do think that he's, you know, I mean, he's an interesting candidate. He, if you had a Clinton versus a Bush, that might level your, you know, you might level it a little bit more. I think he, of all of the candidates on the Republican side, I'd be curious to know, he's seen as a pragmatist. He's, you know, he's a likable guy. I think he would be the most difficult for her.
Would he have an easier time
than
Bush?
Yes, for sure he would have an easier
time.
I was just going to say that she could use her great line from that debate last time. It took a Clinton to beat a Bush, and it's going to take one again. She could use the same line. That'd be great. Nobody remembers. It was great.
I'm all for recycling.
To the concerns about Romney as a candidate, I think that Jeb has some great assets, but I think that he could potentially have some of the same problems if he is willing to be shunted around the way Romney was and has a difficult time being authentic, because many of the positions that he takes are not policy positions, are not in line with where the base is right now. Mm-hmm. Is he willing to be Jeb Bush, and or is he going to end up trying to do what Romney did? I mean, if I can say,
Or voters willing to let him do that? I mean, having lost two white, I mean, look at Democrats in 92. You know, they lost in 80, they lost in 84, they lost in 88. They're willing to accept a Bill Clinton who, you know, was a DLC guy, who, you know, in other words, would Republicans say, you know what, we want to win the White House, so we're going to swallow hard, and we may not be down the line with Jeb, but we want to get back there, so we'll vote for him.
Great.
Let me, we're almost out of time, so let me ask one final question and go back to President Obama, which is, since we're talking about 2016, by then he will be leaving office after his second term. How do you, I'm just curious, briefly, how do you each think Obama will be remembered in the long term? Is he a transformational figure in some way or another as the first African-American president who perhaps creates some new, ushers in a new period of Democratic dominance based on changing demographics? Is he just a manager who presides over 8 years of a bumpy economy? What ultimately, and maybe this is too soon to ask, but what ultimately do you think Obama will mean?
I don't think that it will be, you know, people are, my grandkids won't be talking about Barack Obama the way everyone still talks about Kennedy. And they're, you know, hopefully not for, anyway, maybe that's a bad example. But, you know, I think this is, it's historic in the election of the first African-American president, for sure and always, and coming out of financial crisis and Great Recession. Those are historic moments, and he will always have those. And I, my sort of dream is that, you know, when earlier when people were talking about the second term and I didn't really say anything, I have a hard time figuring out what this is, his second term is all about. But my hunch is that it's fundamentally, it's like about who he is. He's a guy who champions rights for all kinds of people, children, you know, gay equality, and that, you know, he will chip away at this as he has done with Obamacare, right, and now with all these other things. And then he's going to be so young when he finishes. And so I think his legacy actually isn't written when he leaves the White House. That he goes on to do, I think, something phenomenal, but it will be post-presidency. But it will be in this spirit of championing rights and bringing more equality, you know, that real core American value of equality of opportunity. And I think that's what his legacy will be. But I don't think it's written by the time he leaves office.
Well, and at the risk of sounding like a chicken again, I mean, look, obviously he's going to be remembering the history books as the first black president, you know, breaking the ultimate racial barrier. And that's not to say that race relations are great in America now because we have a black president, but undeniably that will be part of what is remembered about Barack Obama. But I think it's not clear because, you know, tell me if 4 or 8 or 12 years from now we're talking about Obamacare as the law of the land, we're talking about a fundamental shift that put Democrats in the White House for a whole succession because he brought around millennials and gays and women and young people and Latinos. In other words, has he laid a foundation that's going to be built upon? Or is it all just going to, I'm searching for the metaphor for here, is it like sand that just washes away 4 years from now? We're not going to know, I don't think, until 8 or 12 years from now, what is left, whether it was just sand that washed away or whether it was a foundation that was built on.
I think two things. One, I do think that he is, I think that he's a transformational leader, I really do. I think that him coming into to office and saving the country when it was on its knees, I think the Recovery Act was enormously successful for what it was and has been documented to be so, although it's been discounted by those who opposed it. I think saving the auto industry saved the manufacturing sector of this country. Obviously, Obamacare will end up being like Medicare and Medicaid in the long run once it's fully implemented, and I do believe that all 50 states will sign on because the economics of it are irresistible for states. I think that the investments that he made in energy in his first term were very important. I do think that the race to the top for education, where now every state has a college prep curriculum in high school, all 48 states who signed on, was revolutionary. He pulled us out of two wars in his first term. I mean, he did a huge amount of stuff in that first term. Obviously, he's just starting the second term. We'll see what happens. If he is able to get a more receptive Congress, whether it's before or after 2014, I think the sky's the limit, and I do think it sets up for a really great post-presidential life as well. I think that's an excellent point.
So we haven't talked a lot about foreign affairs over the last 90 minutes, and so I guess maybe I'll focus my comments there. That since we have a few years left in his second term, I wonder whether it's possible that given the tensions in the Middle East, the instability in Egypt and Syria,
North Korea once again trying to run amok. Whatever happened today at the finish line of the Boston Marathon, I mean, it's possible that things could completely shift. And for all his interest in immigration and gun control and reaching a grand bargain on the fiscal mess that this country is in, that the president could end up being shifted to foreign policy, and perhaps that would end up being his legacy moving forward.
This is somewhat what happened to President Bush.
Correct.
By
9/11. Right. Yeah.
You've all been a great panel. We'll have you back in 4 years, and then you can give us your final answer. Right. So thank you to each of you. Thank you. Good night.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.